Welcome to the Provocateurs Podcast, enabling you to think differently about leadership.
Hello, I'm Des Dearlove, the co-founder of Thinkers 50, and I'd like to welcome you to Provocateurs, the podcast where we explore the experiences, insights, and perspectives of inspiring leaders. Our aim with this series is to provoke you to think and act differently through conversations with insightful leaders who offer new perspectives on traditional business thinking. This is a collaboration between Thinkers 50 and Deloitte. And my co-host today is Jeff Tough. Jeff is a principal at Deloitte, where he holds various leadership roles across the firm's sustainability, innovation, and strategy practices. And he's also the co-author, along with Steve Goldbach, of Provoke: How Leaders Shape the Future by Overcoming Fatal Human Flaws. Jeff, great to see you as ever.
Great to see you as well, Des. I am really excited about our guest today. You know, we've spoken with some pretty provocative people on this podcast over time, but our guest today actually sets out to be a provocateur. Her whole career has been about shaking things up and being provocative. So Sunny Bunnell is joining us today. She is the founder of the award-winning branding company Motto, which she started in 2005 with her co-founder Ashley Hansberger with just $250, right, Sunny?
That's right.
After dropping out of college together. So Sunny is now the CEO and chief visionary of the company. Sunny and Ashley are also the authors of Rare Breed, let me get this right, A Guide to Success for the Defiant, Dangerous, and Different, which is an awesome title. That came out in 2019, and they're the creators of the Rare Breed Leadership Platform and the hit YouTube show Rare Breed TV. Sunny has built her entire career on believing in the power of going against conventional thinking, and is on a mission to take up arms against conformity by pushing the boundaries of business. And I cannot think of a better profile of someone to be on our podcast. So Sunny, thanks so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, you talk about you know, being provocative, and as Jeff says, you personify that in some ways. But let's go back to the beginning, or somewhere nearer the beginning, and perhaps we can just explore your journey a little bit. Jeff mentioned that you and Ashley kind of dropped out of college. How did that come about, and what inspired you to embark on this journey?
Well, our story, I think, is one of unconventional success. We met in Chicago as teens. We grew up together. We went to college together, and then audaciously decided to drop out of college together to start this little branding studio, as Jeff talked about, called Motto. And this was early 2005, when, you know, advertising agencies and Mad Men were really still very much dominant in the landscape. There were not very many branding agencies per se. And so we set out to sort of prove that narrative wrong. I think a lot of people assumed that we wouldn't be a threat, and we had no money. We had no business experience. You know, we're 20 something, and we decide to non-conform and set out to have a vision and try to bring our business forward in a world that traditionally had not seen many women at the helm of those ships. You know, that was 18 years ago, and we are now a global company. We work across the world with some of the most innovative brands, and we really specialize in working with leaders, executive leaders, to help galvanize their vision, champion big ideas, really help them leap to what's next, and help their cultures and the people around that big idea to believe in it, rally around it, support it, and bring it forward through the brand.
And clearly it works. I think we forgot to mention in the open that you very recently won a Webby Award. So congratulations on that.
You've got the world's attention
at this point, certainly the internet's attention. Let's try to break down what is it that is working. You talk about the fact that it's fear that makes people conform, which I think is a fascinating idea. As I think you probably know, the first book that Steve and I wrote was all about breaking orthodoxies, but we actually never explore what it means as a human being to conform and why we do that. Tell us a little bit about what your research and your experiences with the folks that you work with has taught you about that.
I'm a third generation in my family to carry that torch of entrepreneurship forward. And so that chain of ambition and determination for me started very, very young. And I think that for a lot of provocateurs and for people who are defiant and dangerous and different, this kind of behavior is deeply rooted in our psychology. We're taught to conform at a very young age. Think about it. We're taught to keep our head down, stay in line, teachers, friends, mentors, our family even, they are trying to protect us. And in doing so, what they do is over time we become conditioned. And a lot of the research that we did as we were writing our book was that we not only had kind of lived it, you know, for the 18 years that we were women in this industry, but we learned by studying other entrepreneurs who had been nonconformist and had sort of shake the pillars of conformity. A lot of them had very distinct patterns. And those patterns were that they had been silenced. And then over time, their so-called vices became their virtues. And the real difference between those people that have kind of become awakened and those that are not is while everyone else is sort of suppressing their pain in the ass qualities, rare breed, as we call them, are really leaning into them. They're letting them off the leash to run through the corridors of entrenched power like hooligans. I mean, they literally throw brass knuckles at the established order. And they do that by not suppressing who they are. They do it by leaning into who they are. Traditionally, as we know, rare breeds are people that have been fired for the same reasons that they've been hired. And they're pushed out because they're different and the way that they think is different and the way that they're challenging the status quo is different. And they just simply make people uncomfortable. And so what do? When we're not comfortable, we push the thing out. And that's what a lot of companies and organizations do. So a lot of our work is not only about education around that, but also just helping leaders and teams and organizations understand that there's probably a lot of rare breeds within your culture right now. And the goal is, how do I create the conditions to allow those people to thrive?
So, I mean, one immediately thinks of someone like Steve Jobs when you're talking about, because, you know, famously, let's say, difficult to work with at times, infuriating, obviously brilliant, but not everyone's going to be Steve Jobs. But I think there's been this script for a while that actually we don't want Steve Jobs, that we're all innovators, we can all do it. But you're kind of going in the opposite direction to that, say, actually, these people are important. Tell us a little bit more about that and about the seven virtues that you identify with your research.
Well, I think it's first to identify what is a rare breed. So the way that we've defined a rare breed is, if you look back historically through time, most misfits have been labeled with a negative term. There's been a negative connotation with them. They're outliers. They're misfits. They're the ugly piece of fruit, right? They don't belong. We're on the outside looking in. By definition, a rare breed is unordinary among the kind. They don't just beat a different drum. They make the drum. The fact is that they are, in fact, rare. Rare breeds have been with us since the beginning of time. So, Des, you were talking about that. Steve Jobs comes to mind. Elon Musk probably comes to mind for many people. But think about the very first biblical story that we've all heard about Eve taking the rebellious bite of the apple. She was the first rebel. There are lots of rare breeds that have moved the world forward. And what have they done? Well, what they've done is they've shifted the conversation and the challenges of conventional wisdom so that they move the world forward. And they're identified by these seven unconventional traits, or so-called vices that society deems as unacceptable, which is rebellious, audacious, obsessed, weird, hypnotic, hot-blooded and emotional. And in the book Rare Breed, what we try to do is kind of flip that around and say, but what if those so-called weaknesses are actually your strengths? They look back historically across their life, they will have seen one of these traits at work in everything that they do. And for probably a long time, they were taught to silence it, push it down, conform it. And what I have seen in my work and in our work at Motto, and particularly the work that Ashley and I do now, and by writing that book, we learned that there were a whole lot of people out there that had been silenced for a long, long time. And this book was kind of an awakening for them. You know, it's sort of like, hey, you're not flawed. You can succeed because of who you are, not despite who you are.
So, Sunny, I love a lot of what you're saying, and I can actually think of, for all seven of those traits, I can think of someone in my life or in my past life who fits that characteristic, and actually, because they were allowed to be who they were, that's one of the roots of their success. I can't help thinking, and I'm sure some of our other listeners can't help thinking, that not all rebellious, audacious, obsessed, hot-blooded, et cetera, people are awesome. So is there a bad version of a rare breed that you actually don't want to turn on and let loose? And if so, how do you differentiate between the good type and the bad type?
This is my favorite question. So rare breeds are, you know, the traits are as perilous as they are powerful. That is true. The murky borderland between the light and the dark side, if you will, is murky and indistinct. But what we're finding is that in cultures in particular, you haven't hired the rare breed. You've just hired somebody who's toxic. Those people will lead to culture carnage. Rare breeds tend not to do that. They if they're self-aware enough and they've leaned into it and they've begun to understand when that trait is at work, when it's backfiring. Because a lot of times when you're new to understanding this about yourself, you realize that a lot of doors have been closed because you've probably shown up too strong. If you're hot-blooded, for example, nobody loves somebody just pounding on the table and red in the face and fired up. You know, some people don't appreciate that in the C-suite. At the same time, that hot-bloodedness can be very, very effective in instituting change. So the goal is not to hire for troublemakers and for so-called toxic traits. What you're hiring for is a rare breed talent would really benefit from someone who's an infusion of being a little bit smart, you know, smart and nerdy and who's able to think around corners and who's able to challenge the established ways of doing things and really get people out of the lane of their comfort zones, but they just don't know how to find those people. It's not like they come with a giant visible warning label. And most recruiters don't actually know the questions to even ask, to even know if this person sitting in front of them is somebody who could potentially be the head of innovation or someone who's really shaping the company in a fantastic direction. But in our experience, hiring and attracting rare breed talent is knowing what to hunt for. It's also knowing that your job as a leader and as a coach is not to silence and compress those people down. Many rare breeds are just searching for a home, and they're in cultures that will not and will never accept them. It's like a square peg in a round hole. And what we tell a lot of rare breeds that reach out to us for guidance, we say, look, not only do you need to be asking and researching the company that you're going to try to either get a job for or work for, but you need to pay attention to the questions that they're asking you.
You mentioned you've got to ask the right questions when you're trying to hire these people. What are the right questions, or what are some of the right questions to ask?
How do we champion an idea and realize an idea? In my opinion, the four most powerful words in the world are, I have an idea. And how many times are you in companies where you have an idea that never goes anywhere? So it's important for rare breeds and people who are hiring rare breeds to just ask more simple questions. Ask the people that work there, what kind of culture is this? What kind of leadership will I be working with? How will I know if I've overstepped my bounds? How will I know if I'm winning? How will I know if I'm succeeding in this role? What is the mindset? How do they address innovation? How do they approach problems? How do they approach the loudest person in the room and the quietest person in the room? Those are really important questions that a lot of people just don't think to ask. And it could save a lot of time if you were just to kind of understand what you were signing up for before you signed up for it.
So I have then two follow-up questions. One, if I may, one, what does the interviewer look for? How do you actually find the rare breed versus the toxic talent? And so let me let you answer that. And then I've got a separate but related question.
Well, one of the things that you could have them do is take the rare breed quiz. When we were writing Rare Breed, we worked with a psychologist and a professor to develop an assessment that is 28 questions. And by taking those questions, you are provided a result of what your primary virtue is. And we've had teams, everyone from Microsoft to Google to Virgin, take this quiz and have used it within their inner departments to define and understand who on our team is one of these traits, one of these dominant traits. And what it teaches them is how to work better together, how to be more aligned. And also, if I know, for example, if I know that Des, you should take the quiz. I'm guessing here. But let's say that Des is just obsessed, right? And maybe, Jeff, you're emotional. Well, right out of the gate, we know that the way Jeff moves through life is an empath. And the way that Des is going to move through life is somebody who just is probably like a dog with a bone, who is sketching in the shower, who's, you know, who literally does not stop, who's working 24/7 to bring their ideas to life, who just cannot quit. Can you understand not only are there positive attributes to that, but there are negative attributes? What it helps amongst teams is that we begin to work better together. We begin to understand each other better. Now, you could compare it to like a DISC profile or an Enneagram or something like that. It's very much in that line. But what it does that a lot of those other assessments don't do is they call out a vice, which is really unique in the business landscape because you're not normally looking for it. You're not normally looking for it, but it is very, very much alive within your organization and in within the people that you hire. And how many times as CEOs and leaders have we had somebody in the group where we're like, they're the loudest, they're the most obnoxious. They've been on the payroll 2 weeks and they're already questioning everything that we do. The natural tendency is for people in HR and people in leadership to go, hold on. What do we got here? We got a wild one. And what they end up doing is letting that person go. They end up firing that teammate because they didn't understand that perhaps this person had a rare breed virtue that was just not understood. And when we understand each other better, we work better together. And so we've seen it penetrate a lot of top level executive level leadership teams where they're pulling up presentations and we got five audacious people on the team. We got three emotional people. We got two hot blooded and one rebel. And they'll look at it in such a way of just, you know, not sort of saying like we need to hire for that trait, but you know, it's like, who do we think of when we think of the king of weird? We think of Tim Burton. Right? Tim Burton was fired out of Disney for Frankenweenie because he was just too weird. And the reality is like he went on to make some of the most incredible films of our time, you know, Edward Scissorhands, like Wednesday. These are phenomenal films that will stay in the world's mind for eternity because they're so unique and different and such a strange world. You just feel like you're on this kind of whirlwind of somebody's magical mind. And I think he's a true example of a rare breed on the creative side of a bit of a weird virtue coming out to play and being somebody who's pretty astonishing with his body of work.
Yeah. That, and Des, I feel guilty now taking another question, but I as Sunny has given that answer, I feel it's an even more important one to ask. So I'm interested after the intake, if let's say the rare breed has been accepted and they find a way to thrive in a company, it sounds like you coach some folks on an ongoing basis. And I'm interested in the dynamic over time, how they continue to stay rare, because I would imagine that it can be kind of exhausting in most companies to actually not always fit in. And yes, at the beginning, there's some novelty factor, but sometimes it's just easier to assimilate, especially if you're sticking around somewhere for 5, 10, 15 years. So how do you get them to remain rare?
Well, I think that it's an education on both sides. The rare breeds that I mentor or that I coach, part of what I'm looking for is for them to ensure that their well of potential is continuously sourced and brought forward, and that they understand when they've hit that capacity or the ceiling within their own career or their own work and when it's time to do something different. On the flip side, on the executive side, right, or the leadership side, where you have people that are obviously coaching and mentoring and growing people within the organization, it's also important that you're constantly sort of checking in and realizing that you're not trying to sort of keep the rare breed trait in check, but you are trying to help coach and have them lean into it. As Gary Ridge likes to say, and he coached me one time, he said, you know, your job as a leader is to find your balance on the scale of tough and tender. And rare breeds often will come in a bit raw, like clay, that you begin to say, well, how do I not shape this into my version of who this person is, but how do I allow them to mold their own clay? And all I'm doing is just sort of coaching them on the fact that they have more in them to give. It's my job as a leader to be transformational in that way that I'm always sort of trying to get them to think audaciously. I'm trying to get them to reach beyond their grasp. I'm encouraging them to fail and to try and to do things within the company and to put their ideas on the table and to speak up and to champion things that they really, really believe in. I think that we have a long way to go when it comes to leadership teams and leaders who don't quite understand that dynamic. A lot of education that needs to happen about, do you know your trait? Do you know when your trait is at work? And do you know when things that you're doing are backfiring? And that is really a big component of self-awareness. And then, as I said, on the executive side, where you're hiring for this person or you're coaching this person, there's also a great deal of like almost emotional EQ that you're just paying attention. You're looking for opportunities to give this person to where you sort of just like nudge the door open. And I've done that for many people on my team where they come in insecure. And what I'm doing is, without them realizing it, what I'm doing is I'm constantly just like opening a door. I'm trying to give them opportunities where I make them slightly uncomfortable, but give them the opportunity to kind of like fail in safety without feeling like they're going to risk their job.
So you've talked a little bit about your leadership style, but how would you kind of characterize it, your own? I mean, you talked about being self-aware. You talked about some of the things you're trying to do. How would you describe, and you talked about that, you know, the somewhere between tough and tender and where you land. Is that a sliding scale that requires, you know, a little bit of movement with different people? I mean, of course, as a leader, we all have a repertoire. We're not simply one thing all the time. But do you have to be a bit more nimble in managing these people? Do you have to be a bit more agile as a leader?
It's true. And that was something that kind of gave me pause when Gary was coaching me on it, because I realized that at sometimes he agreed with me. He said, you know, sometimes I've been on the really tough side and sometimes I've been on the tender side. And I was like, I know exactly what you mean. And there's some people that I coach that I find myself on the tougher side, because their discipline is not where it needs to be. And I liken it to an executive chef. You want the title of executive chef, but your entire kitchen is a mess. And you can blame that on creativity, or you can just blame that on you're not disciplined enough and you haven't organized mise en place. I learned this from Chef Daniel Ballou, French culinary chef. He was endorsed Rare Breed, and I toured his kitchen in at Danielle in New York City, and unbelievable. He watches all of his chefs with a laser pointer. And if they do anything out of line or anything where they begin to get sloppy, he like points it out. And I was like, that's intense, right? That's intense.
I'm going to bring a laser pointer to my next meeting. That's a great idea.
But it works. And, you know, he's renowned. I mean, you don't get to be Daniel Ballou unless you are completely rigorously trained and you are paying attention to every single detail. You're paying attention to every person underneath your watch, and you are orchestrating them like a ballet, not a rodeo. And that's what I tell my team all the time. This is a ballet. This is not a rodeo. I would call myself a transformational culture first leader who's still a work in progress and still learning the ropes of how to do this. But, you know, I'm completely self-trained, right? I dropped out of college in my early 20s. I started my company with $250. What I've learned is through a lot of black eyes and through hard work, and just putting myself out there and pushing myself to the forefront. What I will say is that I've grown from a reactive leader to a more intentional, thoughtful, reserved leader, which is tough for somebody like me who has a lot of energy, a lot of passion, a lot of vision, and can barely contain myself in most meetings. But I've learned how to just kind of damper it just a little bit so that I can let everyone else in my team shine, because that's what I'm there to do. I'm there to ensure that they shine, and that all the while that they, you know, at the end of the day, they if they go on to something different than motto, that the thing that they remember is I grew immensely under the stewardship of Ashley and Sunny.
Sounds like you've learned a lot. So tell us, you've had some great guests in your YouTube show. We'd love to hear a few other stories, like the story about Daniel, and anything you've learned from some of those guests. And can you tell us any of those stories? It's like a rapid-fire version of Provocateurs.
Yeah, one of the most interesting interviews that we had was Charlemagne the God. So Charlemagne the God is co-host of The Breakfast Club, also has, I think, a Comedy Central show, has been on, is often brought in on CNN. He's a very provocative voice in the landscape right now. Publicists and everybody around us was like, you don't, you should think about who you're inviting on this show. Not directed at him, but just directed at you know, something to think about. Like, you're bringing people on to basically talk about these things that are so-called vices. And I said, but precisely why? Because we need to understand without judgment, without, we are the vessel of this conversation because nobody's talking about it. We're all talking about how you got to be famous and how you got to be a great leader and all the stuff, right? The journey that you, that took you there, but nobody's talking about the traits that were the things that not only opened those doors, but closed those doors. And where for you as an individual, as a rare breed, what have you learned along the way about that trait at work in your life and your career? And he was a fascinating opening segment because he's a very dynamic human. He's very smart and he's just brilliant, really. I mean, he's really, really talented. And we got to see another side of him. And then that just led to a series of additional guests that came on. You know, we had PJ Morton from Maroon 5, Tarana Burke from Me Too. And many of their stories were really so unique and yet at the same time, so, so rare breed, you know, without a shadow of a doubt, so rare breed. And so just as we as rare breeds have to know ourselves, we also have to be able to see it in others because you never know when that thing that you say, when you tell somebody like, keep going, don't give up, that unlocks something in them. And there's an interesting story about how the name of Rare Breed even came about, which if we have time, I'm happy to share. But yeah. It was a moment when somebody saw Rare Breed in me and Ashley and said, don't quit, keep going.
That's great. Like, how did the name Rare Breed come about?
Yeah. So in 2000, I guess it was probably around. So we're like 2 years into business and we're struggling. Nobody knows who we are. And you know, we're barely making any money at all. I mean, I think we were selling logos for like $250 or something crazy. And we were just going to quit. We didn't want to do it anymore. And we had this very pivotal conversation with my father, who was also a self-made entrepreneur. And we said, we just don't think we're cut out for this. We don't think that we're cut out for entrepreneurship. And he said, I'm going to stop you right there. He said, not everybody's going to love you. Not everybody's going to understand you. But the ones that do are never going to forget you. And he said, you have to succeed because of who you are, not despite who you are. You're a rare breed. And that was in 2007. And we kept that little phrase for like a decade before we wrote the book. The book was kind of a masterclass in like wrestling your vision forward in a world trying to stop you, which is what all visionaries experience, which is now kind of into the next book that we're writing and into the next things that we're doing around. We have a program called Vision Camp that we just recently launched. But a lot of this is about the awareness of, you know, first understanding that there's a lot of rare breeds out in the world who need to understand themselves and for teams to understand them better. But there's also cultures that need to be adapted and dialed in so that they can create the conditions for those people to flourish. And then you've got a lot of people out there trying to wrestle vision forward. And, you know, the world is not favorable to visionaries. Most people think that they've lost their mind. You know, they've gone mad. And the question really is, which is kind of the title of the next book, the question is it crazy? The question that everyone has to ask is it crazy enough?
And so the title is what? Crazy enough?
Crazy enough.
Crazy
yeah.
Enough. That's great.
Yeah.
Great
title. How to build cultures of possibility.
Nice.
Tell me something. I was fascinated right at the beginning when you were talking, you were talking about the fact that you're third generation from an entrepreneurial background. And now you've just brought that back to your father and saying something which, and that is often what happens, I think. Somebody says something and they might not realize how significant it is what they've said. But rare breed, is it nature? Is it nurture? Are people, I mean, I've come from, both my parents were entrepreneurs and it would be so unnatural for me to work for another organization rather than try to start my own. But I know for a lot of people, that's not the case. Where do you think, what's the osmosis? What happens in that process when you're brought up in an entrepreneurial family? Is it what people talk about over the dinner table? What is that?
Well, I think that if I look back historically, both my great grandfathers were entrepreneurs, but had dramatically different backgrounds. One of my grandfathers ran a car dealership and was one of the most famous car dealerships at the time. And then my other great-grandfather was a coal miner. And there's a lot of story around how he used to leave with a dog and come home with a car, and leave home with a car and come home with a shotgun. And he couldn't read or write. And there was a lot of folklore passed down. And there's actually folklore about me and my family that when I was just born, that when I was laying on my mother's belly, that I lifted my head up and put my fists in the air. And there's a story that goes around in the family about how they believe that that was kind of the first inclination of me being a bit of a gutsy person. And so when I look back and realize where I've come from, I believe that it absolutely was inherently within me. My dad started his company very young, with less money than I did and no education. And so, in some ways I was more privileged than he or my great grandfathers. And I think the difference is, and Ashley's background is really interesting as well. Her grandfather started Ram Golf, which was one of the biggest brands in the 70s, 80s, and early 90s. And so we both have these sort of entrepreneurial strings, if you will, in us. I think the difference is that over time, I think dropping out and also being doubted. A lot of people, when you hear that sense of doubt, when somebody kind of labels you the underdog, I think there's a part of you that just says, I will show you who I am. And I have this saying sometimes, I say, look, be thankful for small minds. Be thankful for doubt, because that's how the rose grew from the concrete. Sometimes we don't realize that the very essence of someone suppressing you down is actually the thing that propels you forward, because you need that tension of going back and forth to essentially catapult you forward. And I think that was very much my story of one where there was a lot of doubt. People thought we were not a threat, thought we wouldn't really amount to much. And, we made it a work to basically say, no, watch us. Comes from within. But I also think I was surrounded at different points by people who said no and by people who said yes. The difference is what you do with a no. Funny story around Rare Breed. Rare Breed was denied like 18 times by all major publishers, the first iteration. In the publishing world, when you're denied the first book and you go back with, they tell you not to go back with the same name, right? You don't go back to the same publishers and be like, but I rewrote it. But that's exactly what we did. We got all these rejection letters. And so we actually printed out every rejection letter that we had ever received. And we pinned it up and we rewrote Rare Breed looking at all those letters. I knew them by name. I could tell you them all by name. Not in essence of spite, but just more so that I believe that we had something to say that was provocative, that was important. So we rewrote the book, but took it back as the same name. And the crazy thing is that it went to a bidding war. And I remember our publisher was like, can't do this. Like, you shouldn't do, like, you're going to really make people mad. But I just said, no, but there can't be any other title. Like, that is the title. Like, there is no other title for Rare Breed. That's the title. And so then the subtitle, Success for the Defiant, Dangerous, and Different, just felt like the perfect end note to that.
It's a great story. Title and subtitle. So super quickly, because I know we probably are short on time here, but can you pull Rare Breed out of non-rare breed types? In other words, is it a teachable trait? Is it something that once a rare breed is part of an organization, they can actually emanate some of that capability?
I think that through osmosis and through collaboration that you can pick up traits from other people, but I just think some people are really wired for it. I don't think that Steve Jobs comes around that often. I think people like Greta Thunberg and people like Elon Musk, they're really like generationally astute. And I don't see it very often, but I do see behaviors and traits in a lot of people that they're accomplishing incredible things. They are a rare breed in their own right. And that's okay. You need both.
Yeah.
No, that's great. And I don't think many Sunny Bunnells come along very often either. So thank you.
My goodness.
I'm afraid that's all we have time for, though. But thank you. Thank you, Sunny.
Thank you, Sunny.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. We've been Des Dillov and Jeff Tough. Please do join us again soon for another episode of Provocateurs.
This podcast is part of an ongoing series of interviews with executives. The executives' participation in this podcast are solely for educational purposes based on their knowledge of the subject, and the views expressed by them are solely their own. This podcast should not be deemed or construed to be for the purpose of soliciting business for any of the companies mentioned, nor does Deloitte advocate or endorse the services or products provided by these companies.